Good morning, everyone. We are here on our first day of the 2023-24 court term for a rules hearing. The rules hearing this morning deals with eviction cases and retention of that. 2203 is the number of the rule. We have a number of presenters here today. I have two presenters listed. I have 13 speakers along with the presenters. We do have a number of written submissions by a number of the speakers. And I would say if you've stated it in writing, you probably don't need to read your writing to the court this morning, but you're welcome to highlight what it is you'd like to highlight. But with that, there are some time limits imposed, and I think we should get started. We start out with Attorney Corey London, Staff Attorney, Madison Office of Legal Action, a 15-minute limit. Please proceed.
Good morning, and may it please the Court. My name is Corey Lundeen. I'm an attorney in the Madison Office of Legal Action of Wisconsin. With me is my colleague, Attorney Carmen Ayers. Attorney Ayers leads our firm's housing practice and practices in our Racine office. I will start our presentation today by discussing the rationale for the Court to adopt Rule Petition 2203. Attorney Ayers will follow me to discuss and respond primarily to comments opposing our petition. We expect you'll be hearing today from advocates who both support and oppose our petition. I will discuss the support, Attorney Ayers, the opposition, but we will both be responding to questions as they arise. Legal Action of Wisconsin is a nonprofit legal aid law firm, and our mission is to provide those most in need with exceptional civil legal services and structural change advocacy free of cost. We do want to express our thanks to our Legal Action colleagues who assisted us with this petition, attorneys Allison Kriegmeier, Heidi Wegleitner, Nia Schmaltz, Charlie Bowen, and our former colleague, now Milwaukee County Circuit Judge Rafael Ramos, along with Rachel Fox Armstrong. Legal Action's six offices represent renters throughout the southern half of Wisconsin, defending against evictions, enforcing the rights of renters, and in challenging wrongful denials and terminations from subsidized housing. We represent renters in dozens of counties, both large and small, urban and rural. And as outlined in our petition, Legal Action has for decades been at the forefront of appellate advocacy for renters. Given this work, our firm is uniquely experienced to file and present Rule Petition 2203, which asks this Court to amend Supreme Court Rule 7201, sub 8, sub 9, and sub 10, to reduce the record's retention period for eviction cases without any money judgment to 1 year.
This Counsel, is could you please address the conflict that's been identified by some of the commenters about this rule petition, the conflict with Section 758.20 sub 2, which is a command to the Director of State Courts to not remove from the case management information system these records until a period of at least 2 years?
Absolutely. So first, we believe that 758.20 addresses closed cases. Our interpretation of that is different from what the directors of state court has stated. He believes those to be closed, meaning closed from public view, as opposed to closed after the case is open and completed. We believe our interpretation of that is consistent with 801, both from this Court's order setting up the rules of e-filing. That's how closed cases are talked about. But if the Court agrees with the Director in that interpretation, that closed meaning closed from public view as opposed to the cases done, I don't believe there is a conflict, this Court certainly has the power to change that statute. The different branches of government have different roles. This Court has clear constitutional authority over the courts under its jurisdiction. That includes the records of the court system. So to the extent that the legislature has given a directive to the Director of State Courts, number one, we don't believe there is a conflict. But if there is a conflict, it's a conflict which this Court can address by its order in this rule petition. The Court could change that. And the court has done that on occasions before. For example, with rules on ghostwriting. This court entered a rule setting up a statute on ghostwriting. The legislature changed that statute back. This court changed it back. So we believe that this court has clear constitutional authority, and that if anything, that statute is an encroachment on this court's over the courts under its jurisdiction. And that includes, obviously, the records of circuit courts, which this rule petition concerns.
But your petition is sort of policy-oriented, right? Those policies that you're asking the court to adopt through this amendment are oriented toward, well, this is disadvantageous to people who have had eviction actions filed against them. And so as a matter, you're asking us really as a matter of policy to change that. Are you suggesting that the court has superior policy-making authority over the people's representatives in the legislature?
When it comes to the authority that this court has under the Constitution, absolutely. This court has on many occasions decided what sort of cases are and are not in the public record. And every time that's been done, there's been a policy determination made. So we do believe that this court has the authority to change 758, if need be, to implement our rule petition. And we do believe that this court has clear constitutional authority over the courts under its jurisdiction. You absolutely have the power to do that.
But is it superior to the legislatures? And if that's the argument that you're advancing, what is your authority for that?
Sure. Well, I would look, Justice Bradley, to the case that was cited by some of the opposition in Attorney Giese's comments, where he talked about the conflict between 758 and our rule petition. And he cited to the case of League of Women Voters v. Evers from 2019, which you wrote, Justice Bradley, where you talked about the differences and how in that case it was the judiciary encroaching on the legislature. 758 may be a case of the legislature encroaching on the constitutional authority of this court to control the records, to control the director of state courts, to control what is under its jurisdiction. The majority of 758 is a creation of court orders, not the legislature.
So you don't think it's an area of shared authority with the legislature? You think it's strictly a matter for the court?
We think it strictly is. It is possible that it could be like that ghostwriting rule, where it's a gray area, and it's something that potentially this court could change and the legislature could change back, and you could go back and forth on that. That is a possibility as well. So we believe that this court, it is clearly under your authority, but to the extent that it's an authority that the legislature has as well, you can independently make a decision of what the legislature has made in 758.
Well, setting aside the authority of each branch of government, the court has established a committee to make these policy decisions. Of course, the court has ultimate authority over that, but these are people who spend a lot of time analyzing and looking at all of the aspects of records retention within the court system. So are you asking us to sort of ignore what the committee has established? And the committee has weighed in with a number of issues. I don't know how much time we have to delve into all of those.
Yeah, my colleague, Attorney Ayers, will probably address that in more detail. But just briefly, we have certainly reviewed the recent comments just filed this week. Those comments don't address these constitutional questions that we've talked about and just talk about the statute itself. To the extent that there may be some procedural or technical hurdles to our rule petition, those are certainly problems that can be solved by the court system through its order, either in adopting additional language to ensure that, for example, SCR 72 section on receipts, which has a receipt retention of 7 years, to amend that to allow for receipts to be kept while the court file could be disposed of. So to the extent that there are issues raised, those are issues that we think are certainly not insurmountable and can be changed either with the court's order and additions to what we've suggested in our rule petition or with technical changes with the court system.
Well, that might make the court a little bit uncomfortable because we don't have a petition in front of us to make all those subsequent changes, and I guess that's question, then I'll let my colleagues ask their questions. Should we be having another hearing, or should there be an amended petition to address all of the ramifications if we would make this change, all of the impacts on other statutes and other rules? Because once we make one change, as has been pointed out by the Records Management Committee, among other commentators, there are a slew of other issues that would be created should we grant the petition.
I want to give you a chance to respond to one of the issues that was brought up dealing with stipulated dismissals. Sometimes there are stipulated dismissals and there's...
I'm sorry to interrupt you. Did you answer the question that was posed before we moved on?
I'm sorry, I wasn't sure you were asking a question, Justice Bradley, but I think that if the court thinks that would like to consider us putting together additional potential changes, we could certainly do that, have a comment period if we're looking at suggesting additional changes to what we've suggested in our original petition. I would leave it to the court to decide whether you would need another public hearing to hear that, but it's certainly something that could be addressed in writing after today.
Thank you.
All right, pardon my interruption. I just wanted to make sure.
Yeah, that's fine. I didn't realize it was that she was asking a question.
Okay.
Stipulated dismissals. Sometimes there is a dismissal and the stipulation is that there will be arrears will be paid. There's an agreement to pay arrears. Sometimes that would take longer than the 2 years that we're talking about. So how would someone know that they could, if there was an agreement, a stipulation, that there would be a dismissal as long as arrears were paid? How would that be handled under your proposed changes if someone wanted to then reopen a case, but it's no longer available on the public record? How would that be handled?
So, number one, Justice Kurofsky, in our experience, and Legal Action represents thousands of renters throughout the state, we can speak from this with experience, we rarely, if ever, see agreements made between renters and landlords that last longer than a year. The reason for that, from a landlord's perspective, is they may be essentially, entering into a more than 1 year lease with that renter. If they've agreed that they're going to accept rent payments for more than a year, landlords are hesitant to make that agreement. Some courts will refuse to approve those stipulations if they last longer than a certain amount of time, taking the position that you can't hold a renter liable for rent after a certain number of months and then come back into court and get a writ of restitution, but rather that needs to end. There needs to be a new notice, a new eviction filing. So we believe, number one, that a number of stipulated dismissals that have agreements that last longer than a year are rare, if not completely unheard of. To the extent that they are, I think the solution there would be if they do enter into, for example, a payment plan where I will pay rent for a year and a half to this landlord, and if they don't, they would be able to obtain a writ of restitution. That's the way those agreements usually work. And then I default on month 13, and now the court case is destroyed or no longer at the courthouse. I think the landlord certainly would be able to enforce that agreement either through filing a new action and asking the court to issue an immediate writ. Obviously, the landlord will have a copy of that agreement, regardless of what happened to the clerks at the clerk's office. The renter or their attorney or advocate should have a copy of that as well. So we believe there would be a solution to that. But again, we believe that's an incredibly rare, if not completely unheard of, problem in these cases.
So this might piggyback.
Go ahead.
Okay, thank you. So this may piggyback on what you just answered, but can you describe the reasoning behind having it be a one-year period as opposed to two-year period?
Absolutely. So we obviously make this request because of, as we outlined in the petition, the immense harm that renters have with eviction records. The reason that we settled on 1 year, if the court recalls a couple years ago, we proposed to this court a more complicated system depending on what the outcome of the case was. And in talking with both staff from the directors of state court's office and local clerk's court, we realized that's going to be an incredibly burdensome system to implement because clerks would have to look at every single case and figure it out. We settled on 1 year because that's the time frame within which almost every conceivable post-judgment motion could be filed. Eviction cases are some of the quickest cases that move through the court system. So An appeal and eviction needs to be filed in 15 days. A motion for reconsideration, 20 days. A motion to reopen a default judgment or seek relief from judgment within a year. So the potential post-judgment remedies that either a landlord or renter would want to do after a year, they don't exist. If a case is dismissed in favor of a renter, a landlord isn't, after a year, going to go and try and reopen that case.
So, counsel, just to follow up, and this is something I'm very interested in, how often are landlords coming back to attempt to collect when there's been a breach after the one-year period?
Are you talking about when a case has been dismissed or when there has been a stipulated dismissal?
When there's been a stipulated dismissal with an amount of a payment due and owing that landlord, how often are those cases coming back into court after the one-year period?
Hardly ever, because, again, we don't see those agreements being made. And usually what happens if there's an agreement made, let's say, for 6 months,
yes,
and the renter follows through on that agreement, but then on month seven, they default and they miss their rent payment. That landlord's giving a new notice. They're starting a new eviction action. That's what we see landlords do. So it's something that, practically speaking, doesn't happen.
Got
because
it.
Those agreements that last for more than a year, we just don't see them ever.
Great. Thank you.
Can you speak to the modification that Judicare is requesting? The language would be 2 years from date of entry of judgment for small claims cases, and then this would be the change other than evictions covered by sub A.
Yeah, and we would be in favor of the court adopting that. I believe they suggested that to clarify the additional sections in 7201 that talk about other small claims cases. I think they suggested that to ensure that the one-year rule doesn't get applied to non-eviction cases, and I do see that my time is up. So I will now turn it over to Attorney Ayers.
Briefly, Justice Hagedorn has indicated he has a question.
Yeah, thanks. I just have a follow-up question. It really goes more to the main policy argument you're making here. It seems to me that if, you know, you were a landlord and somebody was applying who had made previous promises relatively recently to pay money to live in a place, didn't do so, and had to be evicted, that would be relevant information to you. And I understand that those who've been evicted sometimes might have a difficult time, and that creates some real issues from a housing perspective. But you're making a policy argument to me that looks a lot like you're preferring one side over the other, and that the remedy you're proposing is secrecy rather than information. And generally speaking, I think as a court, we do well to not take sides about these sorts of things. If somebody's been adjudicated to, you know, they're evicted, they didn't keep their promises, they need to leave, you know, that the questions about the policy arguments and what should be considered or not is something maybe best left to other branches of government. And by the way, the legislature has, for example, in criminal cases, you know, made some non-discrimination statutes that protect those from being relevant to hiring and those sorts of things. So it just feels to me like you're making a really kind of dramatic policy argument that is asking us to really favor certain folks over others and proposing to hide information from the public, including those who would have a pretty reasonable interest in that information when making business decisions.
So I would respond to that in two ways, Justice Hagedorn. Number one, what makes eviction records different from other court records, including criminal records, is that they impact a basic human need of having shelter, having a roof over your head for your family. No other court records impact that basic human need in the way eviction records do. That's what makes them unique and distinct from other court records and why we're making that request. To the extent that the court is concerned about landlords no longer having this information, we're only asking that the state not be the one to put this information out there. There are plenty of private market solutions to this that landlords have come up with. There are companies whose job it is to do renter screenings, and landlords charge renters application fees and send those fees to those companies to get records, not only of evictions, but of other things like credit and things like that. And those records often present a more accurate picture than somebody looking at the WCCA website and trying to figure out, oh, what happened with this case? I see a judgment was granted, or I see a stipulated dismissal. You're likely not going to know what happened in that case without going to the court record. So to the extent that if the court adopts our rule petition, the concern is taking that information away from landlords, landlords have other avenues to access that information, and it's often more accurate and more informative to landlords than using the WCCA website.
Thanks.
Thank you. I will now turn it over to my colleague, Attorney Ayers.
Counsel, after you say your name, I have a question.
Sure.
May it please the court. My name is Attorney Carmen Ayers. I am the Housing Priority Coordinator for Legal Action of Wisconsin. I help the whole firm decide and determine the direction that we go with housing. And this rule petition was one of the major things that we thought was important to further that cause.
Can I just, I see people going like this, which often means that they're having a little trouble.
Too high. I'm short.
Thanks. Or the microphone will adjust too. I just want to make sure you're heard and we hear what.
Yep.
You're not sure.
You're not alone. You're not alone in that.
I know. Okay. Just
not
enough.
To what? Right?
Just right. Okay. In looking at the response that was filed on September 7th, 2022, the comments are set forth to respond to the comments contrary to your position. Assume, if you will, that I think closed means something other than you're advancing in definition, right? Assume, if you will, that although we do have in this instance shared powers, as the question of whether or not we want to exercise those shared powers. In looking at page 3 of your response, and you don't need to pull it up, I'll hopefully frame it sufficiently for a response. You seem to indicate that if the court adopts Rule Petition 22-03, the records of eviction cases, which have retention periods of 1 year, may still exist at the courthouse. Now I get to the punchline. However, they will not appear online on the WCCA, on the court's website. I took that to mean that that's really one of your prime goals, to get it off the website. Is there a way of doing that without incurring what appears to me rather substantial additional work on behalf of the clerks? I noted the concern of the clerk of circuit courts in terms of the difficulties, the manual, and also the director of state courts. So is that what you're really after, and is there an easier way to get it?
So ideally, no. We believe the records just shouldn't exist. But we also realize that this is a reality that we cannot request, nor it would be overly burdensome to require it, right? Mm-hmm. So we're looking at minimums. We're saying this should be the guidance. This should be the gold standard. We understand that it may not be obtainable, so we want to be realistic. But at the least, we can remove it from CCAP or from the, you know, automated system. Because obviously CCAP is internal. That's something that only you and other court personnel would have access to. And the files physically existing is also a burden as well. But we understand the realities of backlogs. We understand that destruction is costly and timely and that we're understaffed. So we want to be realistic in our requests, so that's taken seriously, but we also want to understand the balancing and the weight that it causes on the people that are directly impacted by this. So just having a free-for-all for information, we believe, is not justifiable. We also believe that there should be a balancing test, and when it ultimately comes down to it, we look at equity. And where is it fairest, right? And we believe that the hardship on the tenant that is trying to be rehoused, in conjunction with the issues of homelessness in this state and in this country, that it's the court's obligation to somehow use its power for good. And in this case, we believe that that is scrubbing these records in all of its entirety. But if we have to take a sidebar or take a step back, we believe that at least at a minimum, not having free access online that could be potentially not accurate information out for the public digestion.
You know, that's kind of a, I'm sorry, were you asking more? Okay. That makes me wonder if it's a little bit of a slippery slope, because I've been here long enough, and so have you, to have over the years dealt with different groups of people who have a strong interest in having records and materials removed from the circuit court website. And that's generally met with access to information over precluding access to information. Do you see any perhaps unintended consequences if we were to grant your request of why not reopen all those considerations? And there are a lot of things that are on the court website that people would prefer not to have on there. And revisit those considerations as well to close public access to those kinds of cases and documents.
So I don't think it's a slippery slope. I think that there are two real essential groups that are looking at this information and using this information, and it's a tenant and it's a landlord. And when you look at those two parties, like the general public is interested too, but really they're not searching out these cases. The main people that are using these files and using these cases are the landlord and the tenant. The tenant is concerned that it exists. The landlord wants to see that it exists. But this is not the only method for either of those parties to have access to this information. We think the most appropriate way for them to get access to that information is the way that it's set up now. There's rules that say we can have applications, we can interview potential tenants, and there's a mechanism for it, and it's not assessed nor charged to the landlord, who's in direct control of what they ask and what they expect of tenants. The information that's being sought after is easily obtainable through the use of an application fee and these programs that my colleague just explained to you. And we think that's the appropriate method. We think the courts should garner and take respect for the case based on what its powers are and how it's reviewing these cases. The court is saying these cases are closed in a very short time frame. They're saying the filing deadlines are quick. They're saying your access to the court is quick. You can give a 5-day notice. But this should exist for 20 years in theory. It doesn't add up, and I think the equity here, as well as what the court is reviewing these cases at, the courts aren't keeping these on its dockets long. The courts aren't reinvested in opening these cases past a year. You can hardly even get a motion to reopen after 10 days. So the idea that we would ask you to remove it in a year, I don't think is unduly burdensome. I don't think it's hiding information. I think it's in line with what the court expects.
Counsel, your colleague talked about the private outfits that can do the background check, right? How would they have access to the eviction information if it's scrubbed from CCAP?
So we don't think that those are the things that the landlord should be relying on anyways. Things that are actually more important is, can this tenant pay this bill? And the thing that assesses that the best is your credit. Your credit score, and those items stay on your credit report for 7 years at a minimum, which is going to way outlast the 2 years, which is going to way outlast the 1 year, and that access and that information is a better indicator than a court case that maybe was improperly filed, or maybe there was no merit, or maybe there was retaliation, or maybe there were other things that the court was thinking about when it decides whether it's going to dismiss or grant a writ. So to me, there's no burden there. There's no abuse of power. What aligns better is a credit report, because that's what most people can bill. Can you pay what we're asking for rent?
Thank you.
Counsel, let me just follow up on that. And I really appreciate your advocacy. It's important to have voices for people who often don't have a voice. So thank you for doing that. But what you're saying strikes me as kind of, it's not consistent with the real world. If I engage in a contract with somebody, and I know that a year and a half ago that person broke the contract and didn't pay to my friend over here, that would be highly relevant to me in deciding whether to enter into a new contract. So if I am a business owner who owns housing and is choosing whether to lease to somebody, and that person has a history of not paying, that would be really relevant to me if I'm making a decision. I understand, and credit reports are meant to reflect that very thing you're talking about. So it just seems really odd to me that the answer is to scrub information, to increase secrecy, and then the remedy being to charge more money to those same tenants to get that information that's now freely available. You know, if I'm a tenant, if I'm somebody who's wanting to rent, and I have, you know, an eviction on my record that's publicly available, then it's incumbent upon me to show that, listen, what happened is past, and I can pay this, and here's why, and here's how. That's totally reasonable. It just seems really odd to me that in the real world you would absolutely care about somebody's history of paying. Credit reports, that's what they do. They score you on your history of being faithful to your money promises, right? And so what you're advocating here is to take information away from the public that's freely available so that private parties can now be engaged, charge more to the renters on the front end. And I just don't understand the policy argument here of why that actually is, number one, even helpful to the renters, or number two, again, fair to business owners. I understand that you're advocating for one side here, but there is another side, and you're asking us, it seems to me, to take sides and to take sides on the side of secrecy in a way that actually will increase cost for renters.
So in response to that, we're not taking sides, although we are advocating stronger for one side over the other. That is accurate. But as you state,
Council,
there are two
Council,
sides.
Would you speak up, please?
Sorry. But as you state, there are two sides, and you're giving more liberty to a landlord than you give to a tenant. There aren't open rules and open records available to tenants to know who's a good landlord, who's a bad landlord. Conditions cases, you don't see that out there. But a tenant has to go in, sign a contract, and potentially walk into something that's not even habitable. And the remedy to that, there's no open records to that. As a matter of fact, there's no directory to that. And so you're giving more liberty to a landlord than a tenant who is ultimately going to pay the biggest price in their safety and their ability to assess housing over a business transaction and a contract that's entered into by a landlord.
Why isn't that the remedy then? Why isn't the remedy more information and not less? Why isn't it, you know, working with the legislature or other sorts of things to ensure that the kind of information that might be helpful is available rather than asking us to make less information available?
Because the rule that we're looking at is what the court has jurisdiction over and what the court takes action on. The court is taking action in these cases within a year. So we believe our request is in line with what the court's already doing in these cases, and we want there to be more alignment between those two actions. So also, we want to uplift those voices, and we believe that we're in a place to do that, but also our avenues and the ways that we can do that are limited. But the court has the ultimate goal of taking into its preview the things that it can that the courts do. And this is one of those areas where we believe you granting our petition aligns not only with the equity between landlords and tenants, but also just the system and how we get rid of backlog and how we make these things align. We also know that there's the avenues of redaction and seal, but that's not uniform across the state. So we want uniformity. We want consistency, and I think the courts want that as well. So making this rule for a year takes out the juggling act of determining, and it takes less off of the burden of the clerk to decide what is the outcome of this case. If all you're looking for is there a judgment in this file? Do we scrub it in a year? I think that's more aligned with taking and reducing their caseload and the harm to them.
So with respect to the redaction and the sealing, is that something that's only happening in larger counties right now? Is that the reality, that if you happen to be in a county like Milwaukee or Dane, you can go in front of a court, you can get the essential remedy that you're seeking, but if you happen to live in another county, you cannot get that?
That is absolutely accurate. As I stated before I started, I'm in Racine County. It is almost unheard of to see a redaction or a seal in Racine County. So in even more rural areas, the likelihood of that happening is even less. So the idea that we think that the redaction and seal could cover this and would take and alleviate these problems. It's just not uniformly applied. The courts have discretion, and sometimes they're not applying that in an equitable way. So this takes out that question.
I really struggled with this when I was on the circuit court, having I was asked to redact or seal these records. And I'm unclear on what the legal authority is for the courts that are doing that. What legal authority do they use to seal or redact an eviction record?
So ultimately, you're looking at the harm. So you're doing a weighing test, and you're looking at the harm that's caused to the individual. They have a high burden and a high standard to show.
I'm asking what legal authority?
I believe that it was a case that ultimately gave that, but also the statute says that. So it gives you the discretion as a court to decide which ones you decide you want to redact and which ones you want to seal.
I was going to ask the exact same question. So
what statute?
What's the statute? Sorry.
Is it in 801.21? I mean, that was routinely when tenants would petition me when I was on the circuit court here in Dane County. It would have been a motion to seal under 801.21. So I'm not sure if that's what you're talking about or if there's another statutory section that I'm not familiar with.
In an effort to try to be efficient here, does it make sense to give you some time to look for that? And when you have the answer, you could, and I can just say,
yeah.
You're up.
Considering I'm out of time, that would be absolutely.
But did you, I want to give you a little bit of room other than that question, which we're both interested
that was,
in the
I mean,
answer.
I just want to make sure that I'm looking at the same statutory section that she's referring to.
It's that trial judge thing. We both sat there and tried to figure out what you can and can't do, even in light of a sympathetic cause, right?
Correct.
So
that would be helpful if you would allow it.
Yeah, no problem. Is there anything else, though? You spent some time down there. Did you want to say anything else to kind of wrap up your arguments? I don't want you to have missed out on something looking for our request.
Yes, I would just ultimately say that we're talking about human decency here as well as court process, and that individuals that are just trying to access housing, which is a basic human, this will be impactful.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you for your comments. Next up, I think we have attorney Heiner Giese. Did I say that correctly? If I butcher a name, please do not take it personally. I'm doing the best I can, and I mean no disrespect in that regard.
I'll try to rise to the occasion here, Justice. Yeah.
That helps, electronics.
May it please the Court, I'm Heiner Giese. I'm representing three larger rental property owners. The Apartment Association of Southeastern Wisconsin now has changed their name. They're called the Rental Property Association of Wisconsin. Also represent the Wisconsin Apartment Association, which is more of a statewide group, and also the Wisconsin Realtors Association, of course, which is a very large group, which has, of course, a lot of landlords, property owners in it. I think the first thing I'd like to say, anticipating, since I won't have another chance to speak, what a lot of people are going to say, they're going to talk about this, the problem we have here. You're going to, and you've seen a lot in the materials about the 20 years, my gosh, these things hang around. Well, if you go on CCAP right now and look at the 1,101 evictions that were filed in Milwaukee County in December of 2019, you will find only 497 of them still searchable. So anybody who got evicted during that month, you won't, if I'm a landlord, I won't find that person's name if there was an eviction filed against them. Most cases have all been dismissed, or as is the practice with CCAP, after 2 years, they were taken off of CCAP. So there's not a problem there. I think it's also worth pointing out that we property owners, in 2017, that's Act 317, we actually asked the legislature to improve this for tenants. What did we do? We cut back the length of time that a writ, which is very serious, a writ of restitution where the person is physically moved out, we had that cut back from 20 years to 10 years. We also asked the legislature, and they concurred, to change the statute, 758-20, to allow an eviction where there's no judgment docketed after 2 years to get removed. That's something that the Director of State Courts has not done yet, and I would suggest to this Court respectfully that this is something you could have the Director of State Courts do that will help a lot of tenants. There's a lot of tenants out there that had their case dismissed, that they basically had their case dropped. A small judgment for costs remains on the record, however, and that is hanging around right now for 20 years. It would be easy to help those tenants out and to take that provision off.
Mr. Yeezy, I want to ask you a question about the first point that you made, which was that in Milwaukee County there is limited access to eviction records. My question is this, are you using that just as an example, and is your point that that is the same for all 72 counties, or I think Justice Dallet was making the point a little while ago that there seems to be perhaps different practices in the state, and that if you're in a larger county like Milwaukee or Dane, you are less likely to have your eviction record available publicly than you might be in another county. So were you using Milwaukee as an example, or are you saying all 72 counties, this is the way it works out, or is Milwaukee an outlier?
I think it's the same, Justice Grosky, throughout the state. I don't really think there's any difference. And that dropping off of these cases has occurs automatically through the Director of State. That is the dropping off of the cases from CCAP, which is where landlords have to go. Landlords generally aren't going to go to the courthouse and sit down at a terminal to try to find out about a particular tenant. So I think it's the same. Actually, contrary to what's been said, I think the procedures are the same throughout the state.
Are they granted in the same way throughout the state? We just heard that Racine County doesn't grant these. I know that Milwaukee County does. So is it really the same?
I'm not clear why Racine County would be different. It's just a puzzle to me. And, of course, the court, as it considers this matter, you could have your clerks actually look at CCAP and find the original number filed, and then what's still there.
Are you saying that these drop off automatically, or are we going back to what I think is 80121, where someone has to file a motion to redact or seal this record?
They drop off automatically after 2 years if they've been dismissed and if there's no money judgment entered. We went a step further, which this court could help implement, and said not only should that be the case, but if you've got a small money judgment that isn't docketed, or even a large money judgment that isn't docketed, and a lot of landlords don't docket them because you can't collect them anyway, let's go ahead and wipe those evictions off the record. It'll help the tenants. That's our position there. I wanted to touch on one thing that really hasn't come out yet, and as I said, I'm sure people will comment on this. The problem with this quick ceiling is it's going to hurt tenants, actually. It's going to hurt tenants and small landlords. Why? Because landlords, knowing that they won't have good access to, as Justice Hagedorn said, somebody's past business record, that person is going to what are they going to have to do? They're going to have to raise the security deposit, double it perhaps, to be sure that they're going to get their rent paid. They're going to have to engage in a tighter screening for those tenants. So that's going to hurt, actually, tenants who, especially tenants who've never been evicted, who would like to get a spot and now have a tougher time financially. And it's also going to hurt the small landlords. Our study had $2,672 as the average judgment that a landlord gets in an eviction. And that isn't going to hurt a large landlord that much, but it is going to hurt the small mom-and-pop landlords, whom we still have quite a few.
I need to bring your attention to your red light.
Yes, thank you, Justice. Appreciate that.
All right, we have the hand.
I'm going to hand it over to
perfect, but it's important to come up to the microphone, actually.
Thank you. So to answer your question, Chief Justice Ziegler and Justice Karofsky, about the court's authority to seal eviction cases, there's two sources of that authority, and I rely on State Ex Rel Builder v. Township of Delavan, a case from 1983, which talks about when courts can exercise authority over records. When a circuit court judge is looking at a record and deciding, can this record be sealed or redacted? So Builder talks about three exceptions to the general rule that records should be open.
Do you have a site?
For Builder? Yeah. It is 1112 West 2nd 539, 334 Northwest 2nd 252, and that's from 1983. And so Builder talks about three exceptions. Number one, when a statute authorizes it, 80121 authorizes motions to seal and redact. Number two is an exception.
Can we hear the other two real quick?
Yeah, fair enough.
Thank you.
So number two I don't think applies in this situation. That's when it infringes on a constitutional right. That's not what we're talking about. But number three is the second source of authority. And that's when the administration of justice requires it. That's the arguments that we have often made to courts of asking a court to, for example, if we have a case where we have gone to court and a judge has tossed out an eviction case, finding that the landlord wrongly brought it, asking a judge to balance the interests of that case appearing online to our particular client and the facts of that individual case versus the harm it will have to that renter in trying to find housing if a landlord's going to rely on that. So it's that court's inherent authority that all circuit court judges and all courts have over the administration of justice to do that balancing test in each individual case. That's a case-by-case analysis that I think circuit courts need to undertake, and in our experience is what circuit courts are undertaking, is taking a look at the particular facts of what happened in this eviction case, as does the harm to the renter outweigh the benefit to the public of this case appearing online and having the renter's name sealed or redacted.
Is that what you think is happening in Dane and Milwaukee County primarily?
We do. We see it all the time. Just last week, I had a circuit court judge deny three of our motions because he found that he did that balancing test and found that the administration of justice did not warrant the sealing. So it is not our experience that these motions are filed and just automatically granted in Dane or Milwaukee County. And we do file these motions in many other counties and do see them granted in smaller counties as well. We also see them denied. Our experience with circuit court judges who review these motions is that they are putting the time into them because when we file them, we're filing them usually along with an affidavit from our client, a multi-page motion outlining our position. They're not quick things that the court's looking at. In our experience, circuit court judges are taking that time and deciding on a case-by-case basis, what should I do with this case? Does the harm to the renter outweigh the benefit to the public, and making that individual determination, which is what the Builder case talks about, is leaving that to the discretion of the circuit court to balance the harm of a record being out in the public with, or the benefit to the record being out in the public to the harm of the litigant in front of it. And that's true for any type of court case. Circuit courts make that those determinations all the time of what's going to happen to this piece of paper or this record, should it be out in the public or not, if somebody asks me to not put it out into the public. So I hope that answers those questions.
Can I ask a follow-up, Chief? So I just want to make sure I'm understanding the Builder case and the interplay with 80121. If I'm understanding what you're saying, and I'm looking at 801.21 sub 4, and it says the court shall determine whether there are sufficient grounds to restrict public access according to applicable constitutional, statutory, and common law. So you're using the Builder case as the common law reference in 80121 sub 4, which then takes us to the balancing test that you were just talking about?
Correct, where Builder talks about a circuit court analyzing whether the administration of justice requires the redaction or sealing. That's what we're referring to. Correct, Justice Karofsky.
Thank you.
Do you think that applies in every kind of case then?
Builder absolutely does. That applies if somebody is, for example, as a family law practitioner, we see this all the time where there are records regarding children that should not be in the court file. And oftentimes in those cases, we're not filing formal motions under 801.21 to ask that the court redact that, particularly at trial, where we're bringing in evidence and asking a court, hey, court, this is a child's records, or this is a financial record. Can we seal this exhibit? That's certainly something that the court will do and undertake that balancing test. That's, I think, how the circuit courts are doing it practically, is making that determination when the request is made in any type of case. We want something that should be out of the public record. The circuit court has to undertake that test of what's the harm to the litigants versus the benefit to the public of ensuring open records access.
I have one more follow-up question. And I'm just my question goes to the question that I asked Attorney Giese, and I'm just curious about the consistency across the state. And my sense is that the Builder case and 801.21, that's the right statute. Yes. I'm sorry, 801.20 is being used more. Is it being used more in Dane and Milwaukee County in the larger counties than in the other counties or not? I'm just trying to get an idea for whether we have a consistency problem or not.
Sure. So I can speak as a practitioner who practices not only in Dane County, but all the counties surrounding Dane County, which include both one-judge counties and medium-sized counties. My experience is that courts, when they first see these motions, they're not sure what to make of them because motions filed under 801.20 are usually rare. Most of the time, circuit court judges are deciding whether to seal things, for example, in a trial position. We're doing it on the record rather than a formal motion. 801.20 is the formal way of asking the court, we would like you to seal or redact a tenant's name from the eviction file. We see small counties grant these motions. We see large counties grant them. Like I said, our experience is not they are just automatically granted in Dane County. That is not our experience at all. It is something that circuit court judges are actually taking the time to consider. We expect that they are probably filed more frequently in the larger counties, but that's simply because eviction actions are filed more frequently in larger counties. The average renter population in Dane and Milwaukee County is more than 50%. In many smaller rural counties, it's closer to 30%. So the percentage of eviction actions compared to the population in smaller counties is generally smaller. So the motions are not filed as frequently because evictions are not filed as frequently in smaller counties because of the population. I hope that answers your question.
Understood. Thank you.
Thank you.
Sure, but we really are starting to run a little bit beyond this. Yeah.
So just to give a perspective of what Racine County was doing for the last 2 years before the most recent judicial transfer, instead of granting those motions, they were instead turning eviction actions into money judgment actions, even if it wasn't requested. That was their workaround of the redaction or seal request. So they
Council,
just,
which county did you say that was?
Racine. So instead, what they were doing is they were transferring the code, taking it out of, and then this rule wouldn't even apply to those cases, even though that's where it started. So I think that's a relevant thing to how those things weren't even making it. Those motions were being denied, and they had thought of their own remedy instead.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you. All right. Moving forward, Patricia LaCrosse. Madison Organizing in Strength, Equity, and Solidarity.
Good morning, and a profound thank you to the court for hearing this case and us community members. My last 10 years as an educator in the Madison School District were largely spent in homeless shelters, supporting families with young children. I provided early childhood education and parenting experiences and worked with the school liaison for homeless students to assure that children could get enrolled in a timely fashion in Head Start or their school. And as stated, I am active in a community organization, Moses, that is working to eradicate that childhood to school to prison pipeline. And I'm a current member of the board of the Homeless Services Coalition here in Madison and Dane County. So I come hearing hundreds of stories from families that I have known and informed by current studies on the impact of poverty and insecure housing on young children. I urge the court to reduce from 20 years to 1 the records of eviction filings, especially given the low percentage of those that have actually resulted in a eviction. Evictions or records of such threats are directly related to poor nutrition, sleep habits, health, and attendance in school of young children. We all know that those lead to behavioral difficulties due to stress, maybe hunger, and thus diminished capacity to learn and to thrive in school. We don't know what that child would have been capable of had they been in secure housing. The insufficiency of affordable housing often keeps families without a home for years, doubling up necessarily at times with friends or family. Also strains their social networks because they compromise the lease that family or friend might have. That makes it harder yet to maintain ongoing child care, and it can cost people their jobs due to change in transportation needs. It also saps parents of the ability to focus on their children's needs. For things like reliable schedules of meals and sleep time, getting to school on time, knowing where they'll be going to school if they've had to move from one city to another, losing records from doctors and from schools, so further compromising the emotional and social well-being of both parents and children. I was a home visitor with St. Vincent de Paul from 1986 here in Madison, having just come from teaching high school on the south side of Chicago the previous 6 years. I know, and we all know, that black women in Wisconsin are more likely to have such filings against them. And in an ever more competitive market, that leads to even greater racial disparity for adults and their precious children. When someone in a family or home unit gets an eviction filing due to arrest, the whole family suffers regardless of the court outcome. And we are well aware that shelters are often full. Eviction filing, having one on record, is one of the top two reasons why people are denied housing. Even harder for individuals who exit jail or prison with such a filing to find housing. And housing is one of the most critical factors to avoid returning to prison, further stressing the networks of families and communities. I really believe that this cycle is not inevitable and not necessary, and reducing the time that these filings are on record helps to disrupt it. So I see the ruling as a time of urgency now, the right thing to do for us, because I believe that Wisconsin can be better. Thank you.
Thank you. And thank you for your good work. Carlo Escueda, Dane County Clerk of Circuit Court.
Thank you very much, Chief Justice and Justices of this Court, for this opportunity to testify before you. As noted, I am Carlo Esqueda. I've been the Clerk of Circuit Court in Dane County for almost 17 years now. Some of the points I was going to make have already been made, so that's to the benefit of all of us. I believe that if this petition were to be granted, it would not have the effect that the petitioners hope it would have because of the obstacles thrown up by that provision of 758 and also 7201 sub 48. But let's say for a moment that if you granted it, it would have the intended effect. And I believe the intended effect is to get these cases off the WCCA website within 1 year. The petitioners note on page 14 of their supporting memo that granting this petition with those resulting effects will reduce the workload of circuit court judges and clerks of court throughout the state by eliminating the need to file those motions. I do not believe that that's what would actually happen. I believe that the number of such motions will only increase over time, and I predict by a lot. I say this because I ran a list of Dane County eviction cases where such motions were filed from January 2nd of this year through the end of August. There were 485 cases on the list. I then stepped through each one individually to compare the date that the motion to seal or redact was filed versus the disposition date of that eviction case. The median elapsed time between these events was 36 days. 74% of these cases had the motions to seal or redact filed within 6 months of case disposition. Only 11% of these seal redact motions were filed after a year had passed from case disposition. Many of these cases had the motions filed on the very same day of the disposition. So the petitioners imply that 1 year on the website would be acceptable, but current practice indicates otherwise. I understand that defendants want their names off the website far more quickly than 1 year. Frankly, after today, I expect to start seeing these motions filed on all eviction actions, whether they're dismissed or even whether a judgment of eviction is entered.
You sound a bit beleaguered, I think.
It is turning into an administrative issue, both for circuit court judges who have to entertain the motions, but then especially for the clerks who have to do these redactions using the CCAP system.
Speak to me about the issue of the receipt staying as a matter of record. You indicate in your filing that what the petitioners are seeking to accomplish cannot be accomplished, not even so easily, but perhaps not at all without substantial change. Specifically address the receipt issue.
So that receipt issue boils down to the way that the CCAP purge application works, the way that it's programmed. There may be a programmatic solution to it, but I don't know what that is. What I do know is that the dismissed cases could, under rule, be purged after 5 years. If I were to run a purge list for eviction cases today, there would be no cases on that list that were disposed earlier than 7 years ago, and that's because the logic of the system sees that these cases have receipts, and therefore sub 48 applies, and they will remain in my records.
Okay. Dr. No. Tell me how the petitioner's desires with regard to their petition can in large part be accomplished. Or is it impossible?
The only thing that comes to mind, frankly, Justice, is the nuclear option, which is just take the website down. Take it down altogether. I don't really want that to happen, but I worked in the courts for many years before the website existed. People had to come to courthouses to get records. That's just the way it was. As long as we have the website and it's as open as it is, and I like the fact, don't get me wrong, I like the fact that these records are available. It creates these problems that bring advocacy groups before you to talk about issues like this one.
So your response to my inquiry is the nuclear option. That's the only option you have to offer as a middle ground, so to speak?
Without changes in law, I believe that that's true. I mean, perhaps there would be a mechanism to... You may be familiar with the WCCA Oversight Committee. It convened a couple times. It set... When WCCA started, the display times exactly matched 72. The WCC Oversight Committee recommended that there should be some divergence between how long things display on the site and how long clerks have to keep the records. if that group got together and if it were statutorily permissible for that group to hear from stakeholders and decide, we're going to change the display period for eviction cases to 30 days after disposition or 1 day after disposition. They could do that under the, I think, superintending authority of the court over its record-keeping practices. That might be a way to go.
Is there a way to keep the records nowadays that aren't then displayed? I know everything's electronic now. It used to be you had the physical paperwork. Now everything's scanned in, right?
Correct.
Is there a mechanism by which we're talking about display and not keeping the records?
So there are, like, for example, dismissed and acquitted criminal cases, I believe, display on WCCA for 2 years. Nevertheless, I retain those files in electronic and paper format for the older ones for the full 50 years.
So you can retain them electronically, like in a folder?
Yes, and then somebody can come to the courthouse and find those cases on the public access terminals we maintain there in all 72 mm-hmm. counties, frankly, where they wouldn't be able to see it on the website.
Okay.
Yeah, the Oversight Committee, the original one I was part of, and I think maybe even Mr. Leaders and perhaps some other people in court might have been part of, and it was a broad cross-section of people who come together with that particular Oversight Committee with competing interests who have very different viewpoints on what should and should not be accessible in computer form. It's not a one-size-fits-all. It's not something that people automatically agree on. And when you start closing access to the public, that's something that's taken pretty seriously.
Right. And I'm not speaking to the social justice issues that surround this petition. I'm speaking as the record keeper who will have to actually do the work that results from these sealing and redaction motions, which, again, we had 1,700 eviction cases filed so far this year. I wouldn't be surprised if the vast majority of those wound up having sealing and redaction motions filed on them after they close.
And you're saying that's as a result of the attention being paid to this now?
Correct.
Okay, but 11% of those, you said, occur after a year. So in theory, if this is passed, then those 11% the courts wouldn't have to deal with.
That is true, but with the greater attention paid for it and the greater activity of the advocates, I believe that those cases that were where that time was enlarged is where perhaps the defendant in the old case just recently came upon an issue, a perceived issue with that record being online, or, you know, met with an advocate who told them, hey, you can get this off WCCA if you just file this motion.
Can I ask one question? Oh, you may, but we are really off track with respect to...
It's a really quick question. Are you able to speak on behalf of the clerks of court around the state as far as their ability to handle the landlords or people acting on their behalf who are going to come into the clerk's offices to look at the records that are physically retained by the clerk of courts that would no longer be available online after 1 year if this petition is granted?
That's hard to say because the website is so endemic now. I worked for the courts, for the clerk of courts office in the mid-90s, and we would always have folks in public viewing rooms looking at files. They could be working for title companies. They could be landlords. We got a lot of traffic. In one sense, we've been rather lonely since the institution of the website. So I would imagine that foot traffic would increase. I cannot speak to whether it would be some sort of overwhelming phenomenon. It wasn't before, so I wouldn't expect it to be.
Thank you. All right. Thank you very much. Next, Rick Vanderlees, landlord and property manager.
Thank you, Chief Justice and Justice of the Court, for allowing me to speak this morning. My name is Rick Vanderlees from the Green Bay area. I've been involved in the real estate industry as a rental property owner, a property manager, and an investor for over 30 years. I'm a member of the Apartment Association of Northeast Wisconsin, the Fox Valley Apartment Association, and the Rental Property Association of Wisconsin. I'm also involved in several other organizations dedicated to providing safe, clean, sustainable housing in other states. I've created, shared, and participated in various affordable housing task force teams for well over a decade. Typically, these teams are comprised of stakeholders from a variety of different disciplines in the public and private sector. Because of my experience, I felt compelled to come here this morning to talk about this petition. I was going to talk about the Director of State Courts and Clerk of Courts position papers last summer, but I think we've already covered that. At the outset, it's important to note that the state already has an approach to records retention that strikes a proper balance between the interests of property owners, renters, general public, and business needs of the court. What this petition attempts to do is move that balance point without seeking to do this through the legislative process and engaging all the appropriate stakeholders impacted by such a remarkable request of the court. The petitioner submits that granting this rules petition will help tenants find safe, affordable, stable housing. I would like to address this argument and explain the negative impact this proposed change will have not only on property owners, but also the very tenants it purports to help, as well as those tenants who will fall into the category of collateral damage. Landlords conduct background checks as part of their risk management assessment in renting to applicants. If landlords can't do adequate background checks, the ones they're familiar with, the ones that they've built a business plan around, they'll have no choice but to adjust their screening criteria. If landlords change their screening criteria, it will make it even harder for tenants to find housing. For example, landlords may increase income requirements, landlord references, credit requirements, security deposits, more upfront money, first and last month rent. They will almost certainly increase monthly rent they charge in order to offset any monetary issues that come from this. All of this will have the exact opposite effect that the supporters of this petition intend, as it will be harder for all tenants, not just the targeted group being discussed here this morning, but all tenants. In short, this proposed real change would have negative consequences that clearly outweigh any intended benefit. Instead of attacking the symptoms, we need to address housing challenges in a new way. Having personal experience with various housing and tenant advocacy organizations, I can tell you with confidence that addressing the root causes of our housing challenges, in a more collaborative manner, is a far better approach than adopting this rules petition. I'd like to close here with a very personal related story. Last year around this time, a couple months earlier, I took a call from a 19-year-old boy. They're all boys at my age. And the first words out of his mouth were, "Do you take tenants who are being evicted?" I asked him to explain to me what was going on, and it was his candor and honesty that drew my wife and I into driving over there that same night to talk to him and his family. We came to learn that it was his dad, brother, who had just graduated from high school, and a sister who was going to be a senior in high school, and himself, who were going to be escorted off the property in a matter of days. We offered them some suggestions as to how they could prepare to leave the property and why they did not want to just remain there to be physically removed from the property. We also left them with specific instructions on who to start calling the next day to secure at the very least temporary housing. I spent the entire next day, truthfully it was I think a couple days, working with various housing providers to see if we could get the four of them into some place before they were physically removed from the property. It became apparent early on that there was no place they could go, and even if they could, because there was someone who was a minor, the daughter, she wasn't going to be able to go in the same shelter if we could find them one for the three males who were adults. I called the sheriff's office, asking them to delay as much as legally possible, going over to the property to give us time to complete our own risk assessment, to understand if we could take them on as tenants. Long story short, we ended up renting to them. We are renewing their lease next week, and the daughter who graduated from high school a few months ago is headed to UW-Milwaukee on a full academic scholarship. What allowed us to approve this was because we could see and count on the information we needed to make an informed business decision, information like evictions, credit histories, criminal background, landlord references, and all the others that we use. All of these allow us to make a business decision regarding risk management as it relates to applicants. We do not want to be put in a position to have to revisit screening criteria to compensate for this petition adoption. This family of four appreciates the opportunity, and we appreciate them as customers. Finally, I wish to thank the court for allowing public input into this remarkable rules petition they are being asked to adopt.
Thank you. Kristen Slonsky, Director of Advocacy and Legal Services, Judicare Legal Aid.
Thank you. Thank you, Chief Justice and members of the court. My name is Kristen Slonsky. I'm a housing attorney and the Director of Advocacy and Legal Services for Judicare Legal Aid, the Legal Aid Legal Services Corporation subgrantee that covers the northern 33 counties of the state of Wisconsin. And there's a couple of things that I wanted to address with you today, and I want you to know first that I have heard and I do respect that this body is not in the business of fixing our housing crisis. But I do want to point out that we do have a housing crisis, particularly in the rural areas in the state of Wisconsin. The National Low Income Housing Commission has data that shows that we're at a deficit of about 125,000 rental units. This is a very, very tight market. And why that's important for me and my clients in the Northern 33 is because we don't have a lot of large landlords. Most of our landlords are smaller mom and pop landlords, and they are choosing from a huge market for very limited capacity, housing capacity. And most of them are not running credit checks, and most of them are not looking terribly deeply. The one data point they do look at is CCAP. It's free, it's available, and it'll show if someone has a prior eviction on their record. The problem with that, Your Honors, is that that data is not showing what the landlords believe it's showing. What it is showing is that someone at some point had to be removed. But as Justice Hagedorn pointed out, the landlords are reading it as someone who breached their contract, someone who failed to pay their rent. And in my experience and the experience of a good number of my clients, that's simply not why people are being removed. They're being removed because they get a 28-day notice of non-renewal. And those notices of non-renewal can come for hundreds of different reasons. The landlord died, and the estate doesn't want to continue renting. There's expensive renovations that the landlord can't afford to undertake. Those things take that housing off of the market, and the tenant is left with 28 days to come up with enough money to move, put down a security deposit, and find another place, or they're going to face an eviction. And that eviction is probably going to be granted because there isn't a legal reason why they should be allowed to remain beyond the termination of that 28-day notice. What that ends up meaning is that someone now has an eviction on their record, already in a tight market, and that's the one data point that the landlords are looking at. You have a prior eviction on your record. I'm not even going to consider you. And Justice Karofsky, you did ask about more rural counties and the ability to have an eviction sealed or redacted from the record. In our experience and by the statute, that is a balancing test that weighs the particularized harm to the tenant versus the public policy of open records. And proving that particularized harm in such a tight housing market is nearly impossible. Sometimes we get lucky enough that a landlord will call a tenant and explain to them why they're not getting the unit. But most of the time, they just don't call them back. We don't have anything that we can put in an affidavit that shows a particularized harm to this particular tenant from having that eviction on their record. But they remain homeless because of it nonetheless.
Thank you.
Thank you.
All right, thank you. Next is Kayla Every from Youth Homelessness Demonstration Program Coordinator. I think also Dane County board member. Is Kayla here? Am I saying that wrong? Kayla? Avery? All right, we'll keep moving then. Megan Nguyen from Eviction Diversion Court Coordinator.
I didn't wear heels today, but I'll try. Thank you for having me. My name is Megan Nguyen, and I'm the Eviction Diversion Coordinator. I work in Milwaukee County, and my position is housed in the Milwaukee Justice Center, so I meet regularly with self-represented landlords and tenants, and I'm here in support of this rule petition. We've already had extensive discussion on the impact that an eviction filing has on people's housing search. In the last 6 months, I've talked to just over 300 tenants, and about 46 of them have reached out looking for assistance with relocation because they've either explicitly been denied housing and have been told that the eviction action played a role in their being denied housing, or they've been searching for months and just have not been able to find a place to go. We've had previous discussion this morning about the importance of having access to information in the court records and the value that that has for landlords in terms of looking at tenants' ability to adhere to rental contracts. But in meeting with landlords individually, and I generally meet with very small landlords, they differ significantly in their business practices, and there's just a lot of information that those court records don't reflect. And all of the discretion that goes into whether and when to even file an eviction action, and we don't really have any of that context in looking at whether a filing occurred or not. For example, some landlords will issue a notice to terminate tenancy after one missed payment, while others might give someone a little bit of time to catch up before issuing a notice. Once that notice expires, landlords differ in the amount of time they wait to then file the eviction action. Some landlords tack on extensive late fees, which might make it harder for a tenant to get caught up and be current on payments, while others do not. Some landlords engage in mediation prior to an eviction filing, while others do not. And for tenants who do have a brief financial hardship and reach out to their landlords, some landlords are willing to kind of work with them and accept partial payments or establish a payments plan, while other landlords insist on having the rent paid in full or pursuing an eviction action. So none of these individualized circumstances or the business practice aspect really show up. All we see is that a court record was filed, and essentially they look the same. And so there's just not a lot of context there that is present. Another issue that I've noticed at the Justice Center is the lack of personally identifying information that's present in the court records. Three times this year, a tenant has come into the civil legal aid clinic asking about sealing. And when we look into the case, it's been they're asking for it because they've been told that they had an eviction that they were unaware of. In looking at the case, someone with their first name and last name did have an eviction filed, but they never lived at the property, they never rented from that landlord, and they were not present in the court appearances. Someone else with their first and last name was. And so this the lack of information sometimes creates challenges for renters. I had a woman I worked with who had to track down information proving that she didn't live somewhere because she was basically being held responsible for an eviction that she was not a party to. And therefore, she couldn't ask for a seal because she was not on the case. We've also had some discussion this morning about the burdening of the courts in terms of motions to seal. I'll just keep my comments limited to Milwaukee County, but when I started my position last October, there was a backlog of over 1,000 motions to seal that needed to be processed by the clerk's office and hearings that had to be scheduled, often with no objection from the plaintiff. Motions to seal continue to occupy 20% of the small claims judge's calendar. So each Monday and Tuesday morning in Milwaukee County, there are 30 cases scheduled for motions to seal. And because of the demand for those seals and the impact that the filings have on the house, on people's ability to find housing, right now, if I were to have a case dismissed today and submit the paperwork today, my hearing wouldn't be scheduled until May of 2024, which is getting awfully close to the year that's being proposed here. This creates a lot of work for the clerk's office that has to process the paperwork, schedule the hearing, and it takes a significant amount of the judge's time that really could be used for contested hearings and other important small claims matters.
Do you have a sense of how long it's taking to get into court in other counties?
I do not, but right now, yes. If someone is at a contested hearing and makes an oral motion to seal, there's a possibility that if there's no objection from the plaintiff, they could get an immediate seal. But the vast majority of times for self-represented litigants, they're months after the case, you know, trying to file the motion, and which just creates a delay, and then Oftentimes they forget about the hearing by the time it comes around, so all this court time has been, you know, put aside for these hearings that don't end up resulting in the person being able to have their case heard, or they fail to file the necessary service documents. And so those seals are causing just a great deal of work on the courts in current practice for Milwaukee County. So thank you.
Thank you. Next, Greg Jones from NAACP Dane County, president.
If this goes up high enough.
Yeah, no, it has to go up.
Keep going.
We should have ordered the speakers by height.
I don't know that.
Beautiful. Good morning.
Hello.
That was kind of loud, wasn't it?
That's okay. Loud is like better that. Than quiet.
It was so engaging to hear attorneys dialogue like you did this morning. But I want to move you off of your legal foundation to the social, cultural, economic issues as the NAACP see in this issue. I'm Greg Jones, the first vice president of the Wisconsin NAACP and president of the local Dane County branch. I'm speaking in support of amending the rule relating to retention of records in eviction cases. My presentation will include opening remarks, emphasizing statements already introduced by legal action, eviction filings and judgments in Wisconsin, NAACP jurisdictions, and a demand for more regulatory reform on landlords. Some of this is going to affect your constitutional, statutory, and administrative rules. Other information should challenge you and reach you at a different level of your existence. Legal action has already laid out its premises for its proposal, so I won't go into some of that, save us some time. And I want to jump into data. In 2022, there were 25,819 filings of evictions in Wisconsin. There was 1,621 judgments. Let me state that the source of this data, to get it correctly, is the Wisconsin Eviction Data Project, published August 15, 2023. I see some of you are smiling. You probably saw that data. I'm just going to cite a few of the data points in those jurisdictions where we have branches, and then move to what I call my challenge. In Milwaukee County, in 2022, there were 13,822 filings. That represents 52% of all filings in the state of Wisconsin. There were 96 judgments. Let's talk parallel here. Filings versus judgments. You heard earlier where legal counsel for legal action made the statement and the comparison between filings and judgments. I won't go into that. I am going to say from a statistical model, the proportional representation of judgments to filing ought to be a compelling date piece of information for you to consider in your deliberations. In 2021, in Milwaukee County, there were 8,151 filings and 193 judgments. There's a gap there that opens up the question, what the heck is going on with the filings? What is the landscape and what is the scope and what is the avenue in which all these filings are occurring? We're going to come to that. So I'm going to leave Milwaukee along there as a county and talk about its representation at the zip code level. In Milwaukee County in the year 2020, the last year that data was reported by zip codes, 53209, there were 914 filings, 31 judgments. In 53218, 843 filings, 21 judgments. This disparity continues throughout the data trend on the report by DOA. 53206, which is a zip code I used to focus on a lot in many of my jobs in state service, whether it was Health and Family Service or Buildings and Trades, basically said 53206 was a zip code that was heavily populated by people of color, primarily black, low-income representatives. In that year, there were 736 filings and 27 judgments. The pattern continues. Dane County, you asked about. Just talk a bit about my county. In the year 2022, there were 1,674 filings and 42 judgments. This is the front-end data. All of your discussions earlier about dismissals and redactions and whatever is not covered here, but the point is simply this. There's a prescription here that opens up the door for us as a state to look deeper into this issue. Same kind of trend exists for the other counties in Wisconsin where we have branches, Kenosha County, Racine County, Rock County. Just let me speak to one of those and leave it alone and go down to my next section. In 2022, in Kenosha County, 754 filings, 104 adjudications or findings. Those percentages are bothersome. I want to now move to an area where we've talked about briefly, but haven't really dived into deeply, and that's this. While there's been a whole lot of talk in terms of helping people pay the rent, there hasn't been a whole lot of talk in looking at the other side of the regulatory reform in need. That's with landlords. Landlords use this data when making decisions about who to rent to, which includes a disproportionate number of renters of color throughout our locations that I just described to you. This information from dismissed cases, settled cases, cases where the renter prevailed, should not be available to anybody to use. That is prima facie, and in some cases, direct discrimination. This court, this state, has had a long-term legacy of addressing issues of discrimination, whether it's out front or hidden. We need to have this court look at those discriminatory factors included in this relationship just described. Number two, the vast majority of renters, given this data, are not evicted. The vast majority of renters in this data are not evicted. There's no legal reason or rhyme they should be subjected to the current records retention rules in the social economic zone, maybe in the legal zone. So I challenge you to look deeply at this equation of what this data represents to the users, whether fair or unfounded. And thirdly, studies show, and this is the most bothersome for me, that women of color, people of color, will be disproportionately affected. Women, particularly black and Latino women, are evicted at higher rates than men. This disparity has persisted throughout the pandemic as black, Latino, and Asian families report that they are behind on rent at roughly double the rate of white families. In June 2021, a letter from the U.S. Department of Justice Office of Associate Attorney General to the NAACP, written by Vanita Gupta, Associate Attorney General, issued guidelines encouraging courts to consider eviction diversion strategies that can help families avoid the disruption and damage that evictions can cause. This is a court. You have an obligation and a responsibility to identify where you can through your rules, through your practices, through your levying of policy guidelines on the counties, what they can do. Circuit courts, I would say. And lastly, let me just finish up with a couple of recommendations from the NAACP. Some may or may not apply to you. While these diversion guidelines that I mentioned earlier provide support for tenants, there's a need for more structural changes in the landlord-tenant relationship, which may or may not affect you. Some may. We need to develop an alternative dispute resolution program to limit the circumstances under which an eviction filing can occur. Number two, we need to require a pre-filing conference between landlord and tenant before any court action is filed. That would address those, I'm going to say, ridiculous filings that sometimes courts will throw out. But that is the requirement that we need to have in place to structurally change the system. Three, promote housing stability. Require more consistent, substantive coordination with local housing authority representatives to enforce statutes and rules by the state of Wisconsin, Housing and Urban Development, and local governing bodies, cities and counties. There needs to be a process, oh, this thing is red. There needs to be a process that could minimize impact, reach early, these kinds of structural issues we now face. See the red lights on. Did that sound like one of those black actors? What's his name, Jackson? Thank you very much.
Thank you. Laura Berger, Eviction Court Observer with Justified Anger. That's what it says in the notes here. I think you're going to have to find a way to... Right, it's getting a workout today. That's good.
Hi, I appreciate the opportunity to speak before you right now with in support of legal actions, Rule Petition 22.03 related to reducing the Wisconsin Supreme Court's 20-year eviction records retention period to 1 year. So yeah, my name is Laura Berger. I'm the lead with the Eviction Court Observers with Justified Anger Observers in Dane County. We're a group of about 10 observers who have witnessed every eviction hearing and trial since April of 2021. So to date, we've observed just short of 6,000 eviction cases. We collect data from what we observe during eviction proceedings. One data point we capture that is not available in the public records is perceived race. From what we observe in eviction proceedings, 32% of defendants are perceived as black. Compare this to the overall black population in Dane County, which is 5.8%. In addition, of the cases we observe, 72% of the tenants are without legal representation. Before the current availability of funding to support legal assistance to defendants in eviction proceedings, that number was closer to 90%. The prevalence of black defendants in eviction cases perpetuates racial disparities, regardless of whether the defendant was actually evicted. In addition, the limited availability of legal support in eviction proceedings and the ability of landlords to use eviction records for 20 years to decide whether to rent to someone reduces access to housing for all lower-income families. We believe this to be unjust and unnecessary. Retention of records for 1 year as proposed allows a better balance of the need for rental properties to determine viable renters and the ability of families who rent to locate and find stability in their housing situation. Thank you.
Thank you. All right. Sheldon Gross, Madison Organizing in Strength, Equity, and Solidarity.
Okay, I think I can make this work. Good morning. My name is Shel Gross, and I am a member of MOSES, which is part of a statewide organization called Wisdom, which advocates on behalf of social justice in our state. Thanks for the opportunity to speak in support of the rule change this morning. Patricia LaCrosse, who spoke earlier, previous speakers have addressed the concerns about racial disparities that come up with regard to evictions, which is a concern I share. But I want to speak on behalf of another population that I haven't heard mentioned today. While retired now, I spent 45 years working with people with mental illnesses in a variety of settings, including 6 years supporting people with serious mental illnesses living in the community. And for the last 19 years of my career, I did advocacy for and with people in this population. The fact that current law can result in evictions shadowing those seeking housing for many years is especially problematic for tenants with mental and behavioral health conditions because, quite frankly, these conditions raise the risk of eviction, whether owing to problematic behaviors or to difficulty managing tasks like making timely rent payments or communicating with landlords. And even though people can and do recover, having an eviction or a threatened eviction shadow them can actually interfere with recovery because housing is a critical piece of recovery, and these record retention can get in the way of people finding safe and affordable housing. I know from my experience when I was providing this support in the community, we spent an incredible amount of our time working with our clients who were at risk of losing housing or trying to find housing in order to maintain their stability in the community. Additionally, the same population is overrepresented in the criminal justice system, and the eviction record, therefore, can make it difficult to find housing when they're trying to reintegrate into the community after incarceration. In fact, I first became aware of Wisdom as we worked in common cause to advocate for alternatives to incarceration for people with mental illness and substance use disorders. By eliminating the current unjust rule, I think Wisconsin can reduce the negative impacts the rule has on people with mental illnesses. Thank you.
Thank you. Grace, is it Kuby? Oh, good, I got one. Director of Eviction Defense Clinic. It's a little bit of a guess sometimes.
I'm impressed. Most people get it wrong. So. Okay. Good morning. As just mentioned, my name is Grace Kuby. I am the director of the Eviction Defense Clinic at the University of Wisconsin Law School. I want to provide a little more context and adding on to what my colleagues have said. We've heard a lot today about evictions that have been granted and with judgments. So at the law school, one thing we did in the fall semester was host redaction clinics. We invited folks with evictions on their record to come meet with us, and we analyzed the cases to see what had happened. So I have met with hundreds of people with granted evictions on their record. And the stories we heard over and over and over again were varying degrees of, I got the 5-day notice and I vacated. I had no idea this was on my record till I... It is, I got evicted one time because I had an emergency expense for my child. I've had a perfect rental history since, and this 8-year-old record is still impeding me from finding housing. I saw again and again these cases where if you were to look online, you'd see a granted eviction with the money judgment, but the story behind it did not match. In my experience, although we've heard that there are some landlords willing to hear out a tenant's story, in my experience, almost none of them are actually doing that. In these big counties like Dane and Milwaukee, where they are corporate landlords, there is a form you fill out where you check a box if you've been evicted or not, and that is the end of the story. I've also seen plenty of cases where evictions have been dismissed and landlords are not even looking beyond all they see on CCAP. They don't even open the case. They see tenant's name on the website for eviction, and that's it, and they don't deny the application. I have a client right now on the brink of homelessness whose case was dismissed on our motion to dismiss because there were no grounds to file it in the first place, and it is causing her harm in finding housing now. These are the kind of harm that the records are causing in real lives, and I wanted to also mention we heard about the balance for the landlords. First, I wanted to mention that these records aren't accurate. They aren't telling the complete story for landlords to even rely on. And second, that they do have another available free resource, and most landlords do require this, which is listing their most recent landlord as a reference. I have also worked with people who've been denied housing because they get a bad reference. And so that is a completely accessible and free resource that landlords can and do use to figure out whether or not a tenant is reliable. And
can I ask you to respond to something that we've heard a couple of times here, and that is that if we did go through with this rule change, that it would actually hurt tenants because it might increase security deposit, it might increase rents, it might make... There might be fewer apartments available. It might also harm the smaller apartment, the smaller business landlords. Can you address some of those concerns, please?
Yes, of course, Justin. Thank you. I don't buy it. I work in Dane County primarily now, and we've heard the numbers on the redactions in Dane County. These tenants had evictions filed that have been since unsealed, and we haven't seen a change in the market. Landlords are not changing their requirements, are not requiring double security deposit. In my limited view, I suppose, I have not seen any changes. And we're asking this to be more broadly applied. I also think tenants are already being harmed. These tenants who have done nothing wrong are already being harmed. And so this idea that tenants will be harmed, but that's already happening, and so we're just looking at who's whose harm do we care more about? You know, is that the question? So I don't think that we're going to see a big change, and it's not a concern of mine.
Thank you.
One last thing I wanted to mention. Before my work at the law school, I was working with legal action in the La Crosse County and the 10 surrounding rural counties, and can also say that I was working in one county judge counties, and my motions were always denied, motions to redact, routinely, no matter the facts. So to an earlier question on how this is, I do believe and have seen this standard for redaction be applied inconsistently across counties in every county that I've practiced. It varies very widely. That's all I have to say. Any other questions?
Great. Thank you.
Thank you.
Brian Michael, Mental Health America of Wisconsin.
Good morning, Chief Justice and members of the honored members of the Supreme Court. Thank you very much for hearing this this motion today and for bringing this important issue to the public's attention. My name is Brian Michael. I was admitted to the bar in Wisconsin in this very room about 10 years ago this month, and I practiced for 5 years at Legal Aid Society of Milwaukee, providing no-income legal services to individuals in Milwaukee County who were at 125% or below of the poverty guideline, with many of those cases being centered around landlord-tenant eviction actions. I currently serve as the Chief Operating Officer of Mental Health America of Wisconsin, and I come in both of those roles as the experience providing boots on the ground support to individuals who are involved in the system, as well as coming from the overall broader perspective of how this rule my support of this rule, how it would help the individuals in Wisconsin. Support for this position comes from those 5 years representing defendants in eviction actions and witnessing the relegation of these individuals to second-class housing that is oftentimes unsafe, unhealthy, and unaffordable for the types of housing that's being offered based on a history which may have no relevancy to their ability to maintain and uphold this contract that they are entering into with the new landlord, going to some points that we've heard previously. As we really understand, the function of these open civil records is to get insight into an individual's ability to uphold their financial and business commitments. However, as we've also heard, eviction actions are unique in that this cuts to the core of a basic human right of safe and healthy housing, whereas a money judgment is relegated to, can this individual pay? Is their income such that they can make good on this financial obligation? As we've also heard, many evictions are not based on financial factors. They could be based on something completely out of the individual tenant's control, such as transfer of ownership of the building, transfer of or the landlord simply not wanting to continue to rent for any reason they choose under a 28-day notice. A tenant with the inability to move after that time will inevitably have eviction filed against them. Across the state, these motions to seal are very inconsistently applied, either through the inconsistency of how often these motions are presented to the courts, but also how often courts in various counties approve these motions. Even in Milwaukee County, through the change of judges that were in small claims court, there was a change in how often these records would be approved. The reasonableness of this information that is provided to landlords and the relevance to their inquiry about this individual's ability to maintain their obligations under a rental contract places an undue burden on those individuals who are trying to seek renting based on a record that very well may not be accurate or even reflect the circumstances that would have any relevancy on whether or not this person can maintain their ability to uphold that contract. As an attorney, I have seen leases that came before me that mandated how many that would abdicate the landlord's responsibility to provide safe housing to the point of a tenant was required to not flush more than 3 sheets of toilet paper at a time. And that is a term that a tenant who is not represented by an attorney could face eviction over. If that is the type of record that somebody should live with for even 1 year, let alone multiple years, that does not provide the reasonable information, and it goes beyond the scope of what a landlord would need to know in order to make that reasonable business information. There's oftentimes when rules change the operation of an industry, and an industry must adapt to comply with those rules. If this change does happen, there may be some changes to the rental industry, but probably not much, because a lot of these motions, again, aren't being made by tenants who aren't represented. They don't know that they have the ability, and I see my time has run out, but I just would like to make a comment about that that inequity, in that imbalance in that relationship of in that business relationship where the tenant does not have representation. Thank you.
Thank you. All right, Talib Akbar, Madison Organizing in Strength, Equity, and Solidarity. Moses.
Good morning, Justice. Thank you for having me here. And I'm honored to be here to speak before you. I am a member of Moses, a nonprofit organization and part of Wisdom. I'm also Vice President of Wisdom statewide. I would like, after following statements that have already been made, I won't go deep into some things I want to talk about, but I will say this. This court has the opportunity to give the Housing Authority apartment rentals a checkup from the neck up, because they don't have to go into long contracts, you know. I mean, using common sense about it, there's nobody in here. And we most certainly didn't elect you wonderful people to be there who don't have common sense. You know, you can go into small contracts, you know, rental obligations, 1 month at a time. You don't have to tie change around renters for years and expect them to be held accountable for that. You know, they have children. But let me say this. Eviction's direct effect, leading in increased homelessness, further exacerbate social, structural inequities. Eviction acts as a catalyst for economic distress, particularly for members of already marginalized communities such as black families and women. Eviction prevention can be cost-effective and may significantly reduce upheavals for tenants, especially those with children. No woman should return home from prison and be faced with a 20-year eviction notice. I say this because I help out in the community. I move a lot of people. I work with the Beacon. I work with Hospitality House when it was here. I also work with Bethel Lutheran Church, homeless ministries throughout Wisconsin. And the problem is a lot of people can't get housing because they're faced with an eviction that happened a long, long time ago. Something's wrong with this picture, and you have the indubious opportunities right today to change the narrative. I support this rule. And I think anybody with common sense support this rule. Something's wrong, and it needs to be changed. And you can do that. Thank you.
Thank you, sir. All right. Is there anyone that I missed that thought they were on the list or wished they were on the list or thought an important point was missed today that they'd like to spend a couple of minutes talking about. Yes, ma'am? If you'd like to come forward and then just state your name and be heard.
I did sign up, but maybe not in time. I don't know.
We just had some this morning, so I'm sorry if I don't have your name. But could you give me your name, please?
Pamela Gates. I'm also a member of Moses.
Okay, thank you.
And Wisdom. Earlier this year, my African-American granddaughter, age 29, and her six-year-old were new in town and looking for an apartment. They could not find one. My granddaughter had no eviction on her record, but her credit scores weren't quite high enough. She'd been living at her mother's place and thus had minimal rental history, etc. My husband's and my willingness to co-sign offered no help. Even though we could have paid her entire rent, there was always something they could point to that qualified her for rejection. My point is that we've made it hard enough for people with less than perfect backgrounds to find housing. Holding eviction records for 20 years is just plain cruel. It binds people to past troubles that they may have worked very hard to dig themselves out of. And it punishes any family members, particularly their children, as well. Others here have attested to how unstable housing can seriously affect children and their chances of success at school and life. Presumably, we in Wisconsin hold the value of giving all of our children an equal chance at success in life. Blocking them from basics like stable housing by, for example, holding on to eviction records for long periods of time means that we are just paying lip service to that value and don't really mean it. And thank you for the opportunity to speak.
Thank you. And again, I'm sorry if we missed your signing up. So thank you for your comments. Anyone else that we may have missed or even not missed that wishes to be heard? Okay. Did either of the presenters, after having heard everything today, wish to make any further comments?
Just very briefly.
Go ahead.
I do want to comment. My former colleague, Attorney Kuby, commented on this as well. But I do want to comment on the notion that if the court adopts this rule, it is somehow going to harm renters. That argument is an argument that landed interests such as a Realtors Association, landlords make every single time there is a proposed change. That has been their argument for decades. We can't have fair housing laws. We need to be able to discriminate against people. It's going to increase our costs if fair housing laws are passed. We can't have zoning laws. It's going to increase the cost if we pass those laws. That same argument is being made here today. The reality on the ground is that landlords frequently charge renters application fees. Sometimes they use those application fees to pay for those services we talked about that do a more comprehensive background check of renters. Sometimes they don't. Sometimes they take that application fee and all they do is look at the WCCA website, which is free and doesn't cost them a dime. So I reject the notion that adopting this rule petition is going to increase costs for renters and have a negative impact on renters. To the extent that the court accepts any part of that argument, whatever harm the rule petition caused by adopting is far outweighed by the harm that renters face currently with eviction records that last for 20 years. Even though some of those cases may come off WCCA after 2 years, the importance of adopting our rule will create a uniform system across the state. It will address the structural inequities that several of the speakers have talked about and that we discussed in our rule petition. So for those reasons, we would ask that the court adopt rule petition 2203. Thank you.
Thank you. All right. just wanted to make sure. Okay, then. We have concluded the comments for 2203 in Ray, the retention of records in eviction cases. At this point, the court has concluded this hearing. The court has other matters on. We'll adjourn to discuss those in closed conference. Thank you for your input.